This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be speaking with leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Jean Lin, the founder of the New York design gallery, Colony. Driven by idealism and a desire to support independent makers, Jean started Colony in 2014 with a uniquely cooperative model. Over the years, she's helped her clients grow their studios into thriving businesses and refined her own approach along the way. I spoke with Jean about finding a way to balance ideals and economics, coaching makers to charge their worth, and what she thinks needs to change about American design fairs. This podcast is sponsored by Modern Matter, a designer and manufacturer of statement-making, decorative, and kitchen hardware. Modern Matter offers a customizable collection of handcrafted solid brass hardware featuring hand-polished gemstones. When designing a space, consider the importance of hardware from the beginning. Modern and luxurious hardware makes an impact on any room. Choose from over 500 knobs, pulls, and backplates, in stock and ready to ship. Visit modernmatter.com to see how the company is redefining hardware. That's modern-matter.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Room & Board. Room & Board is a trusted resource for furnishing homes with modern, artisan-crafted furniture and decor. And now, business and industry professionals are turning to them to help furnish offices, hotels, restaurants, and other commercial spaces. When you work with the Room & Board Business Interiors team, you can access their commercial discount program, 5 or 10 year product warranties, free warehousing, and more. Visit roomandboard.com for ideas and inspiration for your next project and learn more. And now, on with the show. I want to explain for listeners, before we get into details, exactly what Colony is, because I know that it's part cooperative gallery and part design studio, and there's a strategy firm in there as well, and right, so it's a broad umbrella. Yeah. And so tell us in your simplest terms what Colony is and how it came to be.
Well, the 11-second elevator pitch is that Colony is a design strategy and cooperative gallery that celebrates independent American design and supports the people who create it. But the longer version of that is that we are a 2,000 square foot gallery on Canal Street in Manhattan, and the gallery side operates in the spirit of a cooperative, and we represent independent American designers. On the consultancy side, we do a wide array of work, including interior design, marketing, content creation, art direction. So it's been 8 years. We're not the new kids on the block anymore, unfortunately, even though I like to think I am.
Well, and for listeners who might not be familiar with the story of how it came to be and sort of what was originally driving your concept and the sweet story of, if I recall, you're throwing your life savings into sort of getting it started.
Yeah. So I was working as an editor, and when Hurricane Sandy hit, I had a gallery, charity exhibition after Hurricane Sandy. And that was the first time that I went over to the other side from the editorial side and saw kind of the innards of these studios that I was writing about and just sort of taking pictures of their work and seeing them at trade shows. I really got a really intimate look at how these studios run their business and the challenges that they were facing at the time. But they were really struggling with how to show their work. They were making amazing work, but they didn't necessarily have the platform to show their work to the clientele that was in a sustainable way. Trade shows were great, but you know, they were only 4 days out of the year and they're very expensive. A lot of the galleries and retailers that existed at the time and still exist now, the business model was less than conducive for independent designers and makers who make their own work. So a traditional gallery, as everyone kind of knows, is based on commission. It's a 40 to 60% commission generally on every sale. And it just wasn't working for the independent designer. You know, they were making their own work. They were spending more money on materials and labor because they were doing it locally. And the 40 to 60% commission just sort of cut their margins into something that wasn't tenable for them. So they were sort of staying away from those galleries and retailers, at least the designers that were sort of in that local independent orbit that I was, that first Reclaim NYC, that first charity show was sort of tapped into. So Colony was really the response to that. It was the idea that there could be a different model that put the bottom line of the designers that we represent before our own, with the idea that as they grew, we would grow alongside / right up behind them. So it was kind of a radical thing at the time, mainly because it's just not a very good business plan.
It was a radical idea because,
it was a radical idea that we didn't have to. I mean, it's not a radical idea. It's just not a very...
It was a plan built on generosity and support, right? And
yeah, it was a plan based on idealism. Like, it was, yes. I was an idealist. I thought that there could be business that wasn't only about making as much money as humanly possible, as fast as humanly possible. And that was radical. I mean, I think it might still be radical, but it's been 8 years, so it's worked out okay, knock on wood. Well, really the idea, Dennis, was that I didn't want to have to wake up and go to work every day and do something that I didn't care about. And I wanted to build something that I felt would make an impact with the people around me. And that was my motivating. That was my sort of ROI, right? Was the idea that I could build some sort of foundational entity that I could earn a living, but I could also support the people that around me that I really respected and admired. And I thought that was really important to the industry.
Initially, who were these artisans that you were first working with? So who was this group that you brought together and that you were trying to help?
There's two answers to that question. There's the philosophical one, and then there's the literal one. So I'll answer the literal one first. Egg Collective was sort of my flagship first designer. They were and they are good friends. They were kind of instrumental in expressing to me those challenges of the independent designer, the growing independent design studio that was looking to sort of expand and grow and get their work in front of more people in the city. And Allied Maker were one of my originals, Hiroko Takeda, Flat Vernacular, Vonnegut Craft. These guys are all still with me. Moving Mountains, KWH, I'm sure I'm missing somebody. When they gave me the green light that they wanted to be a part of it, I didn't have a space. It was literally a literal twinkle in my eye, like an idea of what this could be. And they trusted me, even though I had never done this before. And they trusted that I could lead them into this, like off the cliff and into like a warm, soft bed of moss that was made out of money. I want to like give them a ton of credit. It's a really special group. But on the philosophical side, you know, that group of designers that I first approached and that first signed on, they were friends. They were designers that I thought were doing something really, really special. And just in my gut, because I didn't have any sales experience, and they were people that I wanted to work with.
So when you're joking, not joking about the part of the business plan that didn't work, at least as you had originally imagined or envisioned or perhaps described to these to these artisan and craftspeople, which part of it was it that the margins weren't sort of wide enough for you to cover all of the expenses to make this? I know that you were trying to sort of come in well below the percentages that typical galleries or even multi-line showrooms might charge.
I think I should back up and say that the model is, I think I said this, the model is structured after a cooperative, but that specifically means that I charge my designers a co-op fee every month. And then rather than the 40 to 60% commission on every sale, we charge a much lower commission, a fraction of that. So that is what doesn't work, because we have a physical space, brick and mortar, in Manhattan, the most expensive.
Actually, on the island of Manhattan, one of the most expensive places in the entire world.
Exactly. And going into it, I didn't even know how much square footage. I didn't know anything about commercial real estate anywhere, but definitely in the city. So all those numbers, when you looked at it, it really just amounted to me working myself to death and then not making any money. Because those in the industry will know, to sell these pieces, you need a long runway, because it's going to take on average 6 months from the time a client sees a piece, whether it's online or in person, to the time they write a check to make a deposit to purchase it. That's on average. So because we take such a small commission on every sale, there's a reason why people take 40 to 60%, right? You need to, there's a reason. There's a reason that that's the industry standard.
Yeah.
Because it takes so much time and manpower to make those sales.
So you mentioned that you didn't have the real estate experience and you didn't have the sales experience. What were you confident you did have? What was the skill set that you thought you would be able to call upon that would make this work and has made it work? What did you have that was your secret formula to success?
The diplomatic answer that is also true, it's diplomatic and true, is that I had an amazing community of makers who were really hungry for something like Colony and were committed to seeing it through with me and helping me figure it out as we went. That's the diplomatic answer. The less diplomatic answer and kind of the messier answer is that I knew I would work until the lights got turned off, you know, like I knew that if it didn't work, it wasn't going to be because I didn't put every single last thing I had in my whole entire being into trying to make it work. And that's a valuable thing that I've grown to understand about myself and understand about the people around me. That is, for something like this, starting a business with no template and no sort of path before you, you kind of need that, especially at the beginning. And that being said, it doesn't last forever. You get tired. You don't have the stamina to keep going like that with that kind of drive forever. But I think that to start something like that from scratch with your own savings, without backers, you know, like I needed to work. So in that scenario, you need to have almost a reckless and self-destructive drive to work.
That powerful combination of recklessness and self-destructiveness, but with the grit and determination that you had an idea and that you had sold this group of artists and craftspeople on this idea. They wanted this community. They needed another way to show their work. And it sounds as if a lot of what you were also offering was both community and consultative advice about how they can get their work in front of more people, how they can perhaps make their work more commercially viable in some cases. right?
We used to have town hall meetings every month with all of the designers that were part of Colony. And those town hall meetings, they always turned into this like resource sharing moment. So this was kind of their opportunity to come together with people who were doing the same thing as them and were facing the same challenges and solving the challenges. And I think that was a really special thing about the very beginning, where I felt more like a conduit for community than I was a leader at that point. I think over time, we have more exposure to the other side of the industry as far as the professionals who specify the work and the professionals who interface with the homeowners and the clients who live with the work. My role has become more of an authority for the independent design community of those types of things, of figuring out how to price your work and figuring out what materials might work and what materials might not work. We can confidently answer those questions because we have the data. We have 8 years of data.
As you say, pricing in the beginning is often extremely challenging for artists presenting their work. Often there's this inclination to undersell yourself or not build enough in the beginning, right? And whether it's a confidence issue or it's just not thinking in that same way because they're not used to having to think about margins or pricing, or I don't know, you tell me how much it should sell for, kind of notion.
Yeah, it's a lot like art in that way when you are in housing so much of the actual making. It turns into what's the value of my time and what's the value of my ideas. And when you're young, I used to teach a class at Parsons about design entrepreneurship, and you don't even have a starting point. You're just floating in a dark space with absolutely no idea what to do. They literally know nothing. Like, I had to come up with just like a worksheet for them to start filling things in, just to ground where to start for that. But yeah, I think pricing is a big one because people don't really realize the value of their time until they have none of it left because they're busy. And then they realize, I've undervalued my time. I've undervalued my work. I'm selling a lot, and I'm selling through these venues that take this huge chunk, and I'm not making any money. And that's like, that's the tragedy, right? Like, that's the tragedy that I was looking at. That was sort of what I was looking at. Was our future is these really, really talented minds and design minds not being able to make a viable business and not be able to have a future as a studio, because a lot of those, first of all, I don't think interior designers and I don't think our clients would purposefully take advantage necessarily of like a low price because a young designer didn't know to price their work at a certain level. But I think it happens because everybody's kind of like price conscious, no matter who you are and where you are in the industry. So we were looking at this future where these guys couldn't sustain their own practices. That was my fear. I don't know if it was like tangibly real or if it would happen. Like, if Colony never existed, I'm sure there'd still be an independent design community, but it really was this like screaming red, you know, alarm that seemed to be going off, where it just didn't seem like a sustainable practice.
We're taking a quick break from the show to remind listeners about Room and Board. At Room and Board, businesses and industry professionals who purchase through the Business Interiors team receive discounts on how much and how often they purchase. This means savings on everything from top-quality tables to accent chairs with contract-grade fabrics. There's a reason more than 60,000 businesses trust Room and Board with their commercial projects. See for yourself by visiting roomandboard.com today. And now, back to the show. You rattled off for us some of the early partners of yours in the cooperative. I wonder if you can take us through the evolution of one or two of these artisans in terms of the success that they found or how their business evolved. I mean, we're somewhat familiar with Allied Maker. They became quite large, probably bigger than some of the other people that you work with. And you mentioned Egg Collective sort of grew and went out on their own. Who are some of the others that sort of jump to mind and how they've evolved?
Hiroko Takeda, who is a textile artist. She's amazing. If you don't know who she is, you should immediately Google.
Because you should.
You really should. Yeah. Come to Colony, yeah. Man. Like, come to Colony and see Hiroko.
Well, and she worked under Jack Larson for many years, right? Yes. And I mean, and so she's quite expert at what she does, and her work is just stunning.
And so I met her at the AD show years ago. I thought she was amazing. I thought her work was amazing. This was back when I was in the editorial side. You know, we have been through it all with her. She had other agents. I should mention also that Colony is kind of aggressively non-exclusive. It's another one of those great business ideas I had that for sure was good.
Let's make a list of all of the business ideas we had that really don't work out in reality. Yes, and this part I love. You're sort of non-territorial, right?
Yes.
Oh, you have lots of agents, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was like so kind of singularly focused on the idea that I wanted to help these guys grow. Yes. So yes. I felt very antithetical to that, to say, I want to help you grow, but you only I can help you grow. So tell your other agents who may or may not be working for you to go, you know, jump in the river. So Hiroko's been had sort of agents, plural, come and go, different phases of work that she kind of focused on. And something that's really interesting about Hiroko is we were selling yardage for her and we're doing well with it. But we had this conversation a few years ago where she told me she really wanted to focus on her art practice and her sort of her wall hung art pieces. And they're beautiful. They're absolutely stunning. And I understood she's a true artist. So you understand, like, you want to find a way to grow that practice. And we came up with a plan on how to do that. And we flipped it. When we had that conversation, the majority of our sales for her were yardage sales for draperies and stuff like that. And now the vast majority of her sales with us are art pieces. And I really love working with Hiroko and I love our relationship because we have that kind of dynamic where it was not an easy conversation because I think she felt like she didn't want me to think I wasn't doing a good job, but she kind of thought that I wasn't doing a good job or I wasn't doing the job that she needed me to be doing. Mm. And so we talked about it and we figured out, let's try this, you know, let's try doing this. Let's try showcasing more of your art pieces in the gallery. Let's streamline the drapery stuff, so the yardage, so that we can make that less of a heavy lift for the sales team so they can focus on the artwork. That kind of dynamic, I think, is really special with gallery to designer, where there can be kind of back and forth criticism, but useful, and also maintain that sort of friendly friendship that was there as the foundation.
Tell me this designer that's coming to the space. Tell me what kind of designer is coming and looking for this kind of an experience and looking for this kind of things that aren't more readily available in other spaces. Tell me a bit about the customer that's coming to you.
Yeah, I mean, our client is extremely savvy. They're extremely design savvy. We're on the second floor on Canal Street in this like old building that does not seem like there's going to be a design gallery on the second floor. You have to know where you're going. And the people who end up our clients, our good clients, are the ones who are very purposeful about their design work and what they're trying to achieve within their projects. It's contemporary, but it's it has longevity, the aesthetic and the work. It's not trendy. It's sort of this contemporary but timeless aesthetic that I think our trade clients are seeking out. You know, we can't really compete. There's so many types of categories that we can't compete in, like these like staple workhorse pieces that are really price friendly. That sort of category of work, we will probably lose that battle 90% of the time because our prices just aren't, because of the way that our studios work, our prices aren't ever going to be the ones that the client goes for, you know, the end client. What battle we will win is the one where there's a special piece in the room or there's a narrative that is being woven throughout the entire project of, you know, independent work or, you know, we have a client right now who's working for an artist who wants to work only with BIPOC or women designer and makers. I think that there's this like depth of substance that is consistent amongst the clients that we hold dearest and we think of as not only our best clients, but also our friends. And I'm proud of that. You know, like I think that that's something really special. And you know what? I'm proud because you can build a business on idealism, right? Like I keep saying, there's so many things we can't compete in, but yet here we are, right? Like we still compete. And across the board, all of my studios wish that they could make their prices lower. They could find a more sort of approachable way to price the work and place the work in the market. But nobody wants their work to be out of reach, you know? But there's just so much more on the table there.
That's so interesting. So you think they all wish that they could bring their prices lower, but they recognize that then it's not a business then. It can't work.
I don't know. I think there's a little bit of discomfort about being only for the elite and the rich. Mm. You know, like I don't think they want to be at the bottom of the market of like, you know, price-wise. They don't want to be the cheapest ones in the room. But I think that there is generally some sort of discomfort about the work that they make only landing in the homes of the very, very upper crust of our society. Because of who I am, that's kind of the line that I tread is like, how do you be simultaneously elite, but also inclusive?
It's a really interesting point. And how do you be with the people, with the artists, with the artisans, and at the same time, recognizing the reality of who is going to be able to buy their product? Just the material costs alone make so much of the product that's shown at Colony have to be a certain price point and therefore, right? I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to like demonize the wealthy. That's not what I'm trying to say here. I'm trying to say is like there needs to be some sort of education. There needs to be lines drawn between what we use in our lives, the things that we surround ourselves with, what we buy and what we consume, and where it comes from and how it came to be. There needs to be an education of that. And I think that will trickle down to all of society, not just the top tier. But I feel really passionately about that. I think that it's why Colony is what it is. And you know what? Honestly, I don't think people realize this. And I think that people think Colony is a great gallery. It's a really nice hidden gem in New York City. We represent amazing designers. But we are in a space, a special position to be able to bring into the room our most influential, our most wealthy, our most philanthropic clients into the room for an opening and have a drink, have a beer, have a glass of wine with the fellow who sanded, not even made, sanded the credenza that sits in their living room, right? Like that is something really special. And it's not what we lead with, but it gives Colony its sort of its depth.
And as you were saying earlier, you're not attempting to be a furniture workroom competing with a shop that's making custom sofas for people versus what Erickson Aesthetics, for example, is making that are much more a very specific piece and a piece of art as much as a piece of furniture, right?
Right. It's straddling the line between art and furniture. And there are some showrooms and galleries out there that are much heavier on the furniture, I mean, the art side. Mm. And some of the furniture is not functional, but all of our furniture, almost all of our furniture is functional. All of our work is an actual piece of furniture that you can work.
A chair is really a chair that you can sit in.
People yes. always are like, can we sit in this? And I'm like, yes, it's a chair. Please do.
Please. Well, as you say, I mean, there was this sometimes almost sort of farcical extreme that some galleries went to with furniture as art. And there were clearly was and is a market for that. But that's not the market that you're going after.
No, I think we get clumped into that world. We get clumped into the design art world because we are artful and we are designers. But I think that particular part of the market is a very challenging one for me because what I love the most about design is that it inhabits the world that we live in. And it is not just about the object and it's not just about the person. It's about the sort of interaction between the two. It's not just about the room and the house, right? It's about the way we live in it and the way that we use it. And for me, that's what is interesting about design. And that's what is magical about design. And that is what is relevant and lasting about design. So the art design market, even though I have great respect for it and great admiration for what they're doing, it's very challenging for me personally because the reason I love design is the human interaction element and the kind of societal and economic sort of impact that we can have.
Interesting. So tell me what you mean by that.
I think that small businesses are what can help the world. I think small businesses can save the world. And
getting back to that idealism that I've been talking about.
Exactly.
I believe small businesses will save the world.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think they're important. They bring texture. They bring diversity to the world and the market and our lives. And that's an important thing, you know? And I can't really apologize for that. I think it's important.
And you shouldn't. But we have pointed to areas where the idealism at first didn't coincide with best business practices. But now you're 8 years in.
Yes.
Right? And you have helped a lot of these businesses you've helped a lot of these artists to have successful businesses. So what ultimately did you learn needed to be done? And what steps did you learn should be taken to build success? We touched on the lack of territorial claim, for example, right? Tell me now the kind of advice, the kind of counsel that you're bringing to the artists that you work with to help them to be successful, and how your business is able to thrive now, despite early on perhaps setting your commission structure too low or some of the other things that you did?
Well, I mean, getting down to the practicality of having a design business, it's not reinventing the wheel. It's about making your lead times, you know, answering the phone when it rings, responding to emails when you get an email. I think that when you're dealing with creatives, when you're dealing with creatives who had the initiative to start their own business and start their own studio and make their own work, a lot of times the business acumen kind of takes a back seat. But over the time that even me, you know, like I just threw everything to the wind and hoped something would stick. But what I think we've learned over this time is that the most important thing is to be good at sales, make sure your production is in order, and don't make something that is so self-indulgent that it is alienating to your client base. My studios are all becoming more established or have become established over the 8 years that they've worked with me, and clients come to them for a certain thing now, right? And I think that there is a certain part of every creative that just wants to buck up against what's expected of them. And there's something to be said for giving people what they expect of you on a creative level. Pleasantly surprising them is good too, but I think those kind of foundational things weren't at the top of mind when I started Colony, but are certainly at the top of mind now. And moving forward, as we add new designers, like we would never add a designer that we didn't think we could sell. Sorry, did that make sense?
Well, I mean, I think the notion of that balance between wanting to take your art in whatever direction it takes you in.
Right.
Right, which is often what's happening for artists. The art is leading them. They're not necessarily leading it. But you're saying, listen, if people are stepping up and buying your light fixtures, like give them some more of those kind of light fixtures, because the market is responding positively, and lean into that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Allied Maker does a great job of that, right? Like their brand has been built into something that is very familiar and very people understand what it is, but they also push themselves to bring new work into the market that feels very fresh. It sounds so elementary, but it's so important. And I think a lot of studios, it doesn't come naturally to them to like kind of survey their collection, survey their sales, survey their market and say, this is working. Let's do more of this.
Yes, I think often that sounds very counterintuitive for artists who say, "Oh, I've done that. I want to do something new. I want to move on.
Exactly.
I have these other ideas that I've been working on." And you have to say, "Well, of course we want to see more of what you're doing now, but we all, I mean, it's the musician that doesn't want to play their top song on tour, right? But everyone is showing up to hear their top songs, and you have to find that balance of, I've got some new music I want to share with you too.
I think a big part of what's working now is that the designers understand that. I'm not necessarily bringing that to the table so much anymore. It's like, right. I'm much more talking about like what we've built together. Like, this is the understanding we've built together, and that's why we're seeing more success at Colony.
We're taking a quick break from the show to hear more about Modern Matter. Modern Matter creates heirloom quality cabinet and furniture hardware. Their trade program was developed in partnership with leading interior designers and is focused on helping you make your next project successful and unforgettable with trade-only pricing and a convenient sampling program. Mix and match sizes, styles, metal finishes, and gemstones to fit each room's needs. Check out at Modern Matter Hardware on Instagram or visit modernmatter.com to open a trade account and subscribe to their newsletter. That's modern-matter.com. Now, back to the show. Let's talk about today and this landscape and what you're seeing and what you're imagining. I know that e-commerce per se is not a big component of how you sell product. It's much more about people coming and seeing and, you mentioned Hiroko Takeda, for example, Takeda being someone that you saw at the Architectural Digest home show years ago.
Yeah.
But I get the sense from you that those shows aren't necessarily the place of discovery that they once were.
This is a tough topic. I think that I have always been a cheerleader for American trade shows to be a place of true discovery and opportunity on both sides. Discovery for the interior designer and client, and opportunity for the exhibitors. I think that the power of a trade show is kind of unmatched in those categories of discovery and opportunity. But I think that the American design trade shows have sort of lost their way because, well, look, I don't know why, but I can just tell you from like my standpoint, which is absolutely kind of like a third party outsider looking in at what's going on in the trade shows. I think that they haven't felt inspiring in a long time. They've felt a little bit out of reach for a certain group of designers that I feel very committed to. They seem a little bit too focused on commerciality and not focused enough on innovation. But I want to bookend that with, I've always been a cheerleader of these trade shows because I think it's so important. When you go to Milan for Salone, you can see the magic that can happen when there is true balance between commerce and innovation and creativity, because there's the huge big trade show at the fairgrounds that kind of serve this big purpose of that drives commerce to Italy and drives all of this sort of business. And then if you just wander the streets of Milan during that time, there's this amazing thing that happens where all these independents are popping up. And, you know, this is a different world now. You know, a lot of the commercial has started bleeding into the independents, but that balance has been elusive in, I think, American cities and American trade shows.
We've talked in the past, just for example, about NYC by Design. And yeah. I know that you were on the steering committee for NYC by Design at one point.
I was.
You left.
I did.
And I wonder why. I mean, what happened there?
Well, it was around the time when they handed off to Sandow. And I was sitting in the room and I looked around. I was one of, I mean, I don't know how many, the steering committee was probably like 20 people at that time. I was one representative in that room for the smaller businesses and studios that I always kind of am in the room representing. And it just didn't feel quite right. It felt like handing over NYC by Design to a media company that depends on advertising dollars from large corporations. Didn't feel like the city focused, inclusive entity that I thought that NYC by Design was period, and also was working towards. And so I didn't think that it was a good move. I didn't think it was a good move for New York NYC by Design, but I knew it wasn't good for us as in the little guy. So I went out in a flaming blaze of glory. I wrote a letter, I talked to Adam Sandow, it was very dramatic, but I think they heard me, but I at this point I don't even really know what they did with that, you know, like, I think they heard what I was trying to say. I think that they understood what I was trying to say about the balance between commerce and innovation. But I kind of think, from what I can see now, I kind of wonder if they even really know how to get there.
And what a show in New York City should look like and be like?
What a design week in New York City should be like.
Right.
There's this fine balance. There's an ecosystem that can be achieved where everybody has a seat at the table and recognizes who's sitting next to them and who's sitting across from them and realizes that it should be democratic. And the more democratic it is, the better it is for everyone. The more money everyone will make. Let's put it down. You know, like I think that if you look at Milan, global companies are spending millions and millions of dollars now for 4 days of a festival. If you look at South by Southwest, you know, different industry, but same idea, you know, like there's a lot of industry happening there. There's a lot of commerce happening there. And those things don't happen if you just focus on one company's bottom line or one big company's bottom line. It has to be a mutual respect between, you know, Colony or whoever that is, whatever business that, whatever small business it is at the table, you know, independent musician, independent filmmaker, and Sony, whoever, right? Like, there needs to be this understanding between the two parties of what you're bringing to the table. And I think that that's lacking here.
It seems as if there still isn't clarity around what NYC by Design wants to be and how all of the different activations that go on around the city and elsewhere are all sort of tied together. And as you say, Salone, which is such an extraordinary show and sort of takes over all of Milan now with different activations in retail locations, and you can go out to the show itself, but you don't even need to go to the show itself to experience so much of what Salone is about.
It needs a strong, forceful, leading mind or entity. In Salone's case, it's the Italian government. The Italian government has a huge motivation for Milan Design Week to be a success. So they put resources, energy, money to make, bring the best, smartest people in the room. They bring them in a room and they make sure that the balance is achieved, the balance that I'm talking about, right? Mm. They have a commercial imperative and social imperative for that balance to be achieved. So they find it. NYC by Design, they don't have that. You know, it doesn't need to be the most design savvy person leading. It needs to be somebody who knows they're not the most design savvy person and calls up the most design savvy person and gets them into the room and figures out what to do, what the heck to do. Everyone thinks that they have the answer, but clearly NYC by Design / ICFF / any other, you know, Sandow or whoever the other parties are involved, they don't have the answer. They've been just sitting in that room talking about it. And we're all out here putting on shows, throwing thousands of dollars that we, like for us, marketing dollars that are very valuable towards these shows to create culture and to create buzz and to create excitement in the city. And we are looking for a leader to help us find that balance, that magical balance. I had hoped it would be NYC by Design. I'm sorely disappointed that it's not. And I wish that it was.
And that it could attract people from all over the world and that it could, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like the idea, it's so narrow-minded. Oh man, you really got me going, Dennis. It's so narrow-minded.
Keep going, keep going.
To only think about how much money you can make this year or how many tickets you can sell to the awards. Do you know how small that is? It's New York City. It's the best city in the whole world. People dream about coming here their whole lives, design or not, right?
Right.
And we're thinking about some award ceremony. That's the thing. It's yesterday. They are stuck in yesterday. And I told myself I wouldn't say this. I told myself I wouldn't say this, but that is the truth. And maybe people aren't comfortable with it. And maybe people don't want to rock the boat, or maybe people don't have the answer, so they don't want to bring up the question. But like, why the heck doesn't New York City have a million/billion-dollar design week? It's because previously mentioned parties are sitting in a room by themselves thinking that they can do it all, and they're wrong.
And their notions are, to use your words, are yesterday. And today's notion about all of this is what? Is it a more cooperative model, much like what Colony is trying to do on a much smaller scale? Is it all of these different groups sort of trying to come together? Is it, what is it that is the today model?
You know, honestly, the thing that's so tragic about this is that there is a model. It's Milan. There is a model. It's London has done a really nice job. Paris does a pretty nice job with it. I feel like it's not rocket science. We're not even talking about tomorrow. We're just talking about, let's just catch up. Mm. If we're talking about innovating for tomorrow, all I know is it's not going to be the same old thing, right? There has to be a room at the table for the innovators, the young designers, younger than me. It's just starting out, 8 months, not 8 years, right? There needs to be a seat at the table for all of those people. And then there needs to be a way, somebody, to get those guys to even freaking come to the table. Because at this point, they don't even care. They don't even want to come to the table. They have other things, better things to do in other cities. There needs to be a way to make it relevant to the innovators,
who have been discouraged by what they've seen in years past and have lost interest and aren't even, to your point, coming to the table anymore to discuss this because they assume it's just going to be much of the same. Is that how you feel?
I think that I sound very doomsday, but kind of,
you were, yes, all idealism in the beginning, and now it's all...
It's a roller coaster ride. It's a roller coaster. Right. I think that they are... I don't even think it's on their radar. I think that they think it's for somebody else, it's for something else, it's a different industry, it's not what they have to worry about. That being said, I think that there is this like trailing kind of whisper slash tale of something going on. People are still having events this year. People have events. People still talk about NYC by design. There's still a thing there, right? Because there has to be. It's New York City.
Sure.
But what I'm talking about is making it into something global and thinking big rather than just thriving, rather than just surviving. You know what I mean? Mm. So in that case, yeah, we got to innovate. We got to make room for people at the table. We got to knock on doors that we haven't knocked on before. We have to find a leader. We have to find a leader that's appealing to both the commercial side of things and the young independent side of things. Like, that needs to happen for this to work. Or it's just going to keep going, and it's going to keep kind of limping along and getting by on the fact that it's New York City. And that's sad to me.
What can you tell us about the show you're about to put up?
Well, thanks for asking. I mean, so I designed a collection of vases, glass vases. I wanted to find a way to work charitable giving back into Colony's fabric in a meaningful way. So it's a collection series. This is the first. It's called Philatera. And it's a collection of glass vases, one of a kind, limited run. Proceeds from the sales are going to the Environmental Defense Funds and the Rainforest Foundation, US. Each subsequent collection is going to be inspired by the charity that proceeds are going to go to. So it's a really poetic way of representing how all of us are really singular and unique and one-offs. It kind of represents that, how when we come together, even though we're all very fragile, when we come together, you can change a landscape.
Back to the idealism again, it sounds
yeah.
like.
It always comes back to idealism for me. It's so embarrassing. If you can find us, you will be inspired.
If you can find us, it will be worth
it. Not easy. You have to wade through a sea of counterfeit bags on Canal Street. But once you get through that sea, I promise you, you will be inspired.
It is going to be worth the effort.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest design industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job listings, and join our BOH Insider community for access to online workshops, a free print subscription, and much more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others to discover the show. This show was produced by Fred Nicolaus and Caroline Burke and edited by Michael Castaneda. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.